AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We're on the Friday edition of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, here on this Friday afternoon, we're going to be checking in with our expert political analyst. That would be David Schultz, political science professor over at Hamline University, who also writes on the blog, schultzstake.blogspot.com, as we're going to be talking about several topics, including federal policing and comparing 2016 polling to 2020. So, David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all the listeners for tuning in.
Yeah, let's start off talking about 2016 and comparing that to 2020, because as we see with a lot of the poll aggregators right now, Biden has opened up a wide lead over Donald Trump, similar to how Hillary Clinton opened up at times a wide lead against Donald Trump in 2016. Now, the Trump campaign counters that there are lots of secret voters, or people who are members of the silent majority. Do you buy into this theory that there somehow exists these hidden voters that in the end are going to vote for Trump?
It hasn't really panned out whatsoever in terms of that. There were many people who were speculating back in 2016 that with Clinton's lead, that Trump would eventually win the popular vote because there would be all these secret voters hesitant maybe to tell people or tell pollsters who they were voting for. But at the end of the day, when we looked at it in 2016, the best national polls, and I want to preface that by saying national polls, said that Secretary Clinton would win the presidential popular vote by about 2 to 3 percentage points with about a plus or minus, you know, three point margin of error. And guess what? She won the national popular vote by about 2% of the vote. So the national polls were exactly on score, and the same thing in the critical swing states. You know, those states like back then, such as Ohio, Pennsylvania, and so forth, that once we looked at the last set of polls right before the election, they were pretty much on score in terms of where the pollsters were predicting. This is a long-winded way of saying that there wasn't evidence back in 2016 that there was a real gap between what the polls were telling us and the sort of the covert secret Trump voters. And I suspect the same thing is going to occur in 2020, that the polls, remember, are snapshots in time. They're not predictors of the future. That they probably do accurately predict where American public opinion is right now. The question is, are these the same people who are going to vote come November? Are these the people who are going to shake out in terms of affecting the critical swing states? So largely, I would reject the Trump argument. And think about also what happened for the last election, as well as back in 2012. There were lots of Republicans who were arguing that the polls were biased, and they kept trying to say that we have to, what, unskew them, you know, correct them in some way, shape, or form. And at the end of the day, they weren't skewed. They really were accurate. Pollsters, despite all the problems, are largely getting it right.
I think what's also interesting to look at in 2016, especially if you look at the poll aggregators, there were several instances in 16 where I think this happened 3 or 4 times during the spring, summer, and fall of that year, where Hillary Clinton's lead had narrowed to the race being even. In fact, I think there was even one point of the summer where Trump very slightly went ahead. So it was also a very fluid race that we saw back to during that cycle. And in 2020, we're not really seeing that. It's been a very steady lead for Biden. So kind of describe who some of these voters are who might have gone for Trump in 16 that are now firmly in Biden's camp, because the way I read it back in 16, we had several maybe right-leaning centrists who were kind of wavering between going for Hillary versus going for Trump, rather. And in 2020, they seem to be firmly in Joe Biden's camp.
So I think you're absolutely correct that we're seeing a greater sense of stability in the polls, let us say, starting about a month or so ago, as opposed to what we saw 4 years ago. Now, there's a variety of reasons to explain this before we get to the particular people here, is that 4 years ago, we had two candidates, Trump and Clinton, who were both significantly unpopular. Depending on which poll you looked at, both of them had disapproval ratings of approaching 60%. Now, it's not the same 60%, but nonetheless, very high disapprovals. And that created part of the fluidity that there were a lot of voters who just didn't like either of the candidates. And the question was for them, you know, were they going to vote for the lesser of two evils? Were they going to maybe not vote? And what we know at the end of the day is that a lot of them disliked Hillary Clinton more than they disliked Donald Trump, at least in those critical swing states. And these were individuals, for example, that included, as you suggested, some, let us say, more moderate Republicans. In some cases, it was suburban women who maybe didn't vote for Trump necessarily, but who stayed home from voting. And we could just in general say that really what happened is that Democrats stayed home in 2016. And that's the big story, is that if we look at, like, for example, the state of Minnesota, you know, where Trump got within 50,000 votes of beating Hillary Clinton in Minnesota, it's not that there was a surge of Republican turnout. In fact, Trump only received about 2,000 more votes in 2016 than Mitt Romney received in 2012. The problem was that Democrats stayed home on Election Day. They just were not excited by Hillary Clinton, or the Clinton campaign didn't come back to Minnesota to recruit a campaign, and she made similar mistakes in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and in Michigan. And that's important, because when people think, well, this, you know, the election was about a Republican surge. No, it was more about just Democrats opting to sit home on Election Day, which is why turnout is so critical. So I would argue that, yes, while there were some of those voters, and we're seeing it this year, we're seeing some of the elderly concerned about Trump's handling of the coronavirus. Some of them seem to be breaking at this point towards Joe Biden. We're seeing maybe some of those suburban women who are now highly motivated to come out and vote. But a lot of it now is what? The Democrats have made up their mind. The Democrats have made up their mind. Unlike all these stories that are in the news of asking, well, are the progressives going to come out? Are the Bernie people going to come out for Biden? Largely at the end of the day, we're seeing the Democrats come together and decide and say that we would, whatever we may think of Biden, he's our candidate and he's far better than Donald Trump. And so that, I think, is critical, that this is a referendum on Donald Trump. People know who he is now. They don't like him, and they're willing to go along with Biden. And that's this part of the stability that we're seeing now.
It's interesting in how the base of the Democrats is being motivated. And I think this is true for both political parties, is that generally when you talk about having a motivated base, you're talking about having a specific candidate that really inspires people to go out and vote for them. And what we're kind of seeing here in 2020 is the exact opposite effect among Democrats. While, as you talked about, Biden isn't necessarily viewed as a scary candidate or quite as negatively as Hillary Clinton, people are much more dedicated towards voting against Donald Trump in 2020. That's especially true when you look at those favorable and unfavorable ratings, or the ones I like looking at are the very unfavorables versus very favorables. And Biden's doing quite well in those categories compared to Trump when you look at how many people view Donald Trump very unfavorably. So I guess it's a long-winded way of saying it's kind of a unique way that Biden is approaching the base, where it's more about the opponent than actually him.
No, you're absolutely correct. And also, just reinforcing that, there was a poll that was done about a month or two ago, I'm forgetting who did it now, that pointed out, I think, something that you were trying to articulate here, which is that among people who don't like either candidate, there's a far greater dislike among those voters for Trump than there is for Biden. And again, that's critical, because 4 years ago, the percentage of people who disliked Clinton was dramatically higher among those critical, like, let's say, undecided or swing voters than those who dislike Trump. And so, with, again, at this point, we have, as I said before, an election, and you're saying the same thing, that really is, at the end of the day, no matter what anybody thinks, it's a referendum on Trump. People, unlike 4 years ago, don't have another candidate they dislike that they're comparing to. Here, it's all about Trump, and Biden is viewed anywhere from some people who are very enthusiastic to him. There's probably a small percentage who really dislike him, but for a lot of people, he doesn't carry the negative baggage in the way that Donald Trump does, or in the way that Secretary Clinton carried 4 years ago.
Yeah, I think that poll you're referring to, it was like Biden leading among people who dislike both candidates by just a super wide margin. I think it was like 60 yeah. to 10, where Trump had won that category narrowly back in 16. And yeah, it just might be the case, as you're saying, where he's just not as scary to suburban voters as Hillary Clinton was.
No, I think it's critical that in many ways, Joe Biden is perhaps the perfect candidate in some ways in 2016. Now, I know a lot of the more progressive Democrats are going to say, oh, no, he's not the perfect candidate. But if in part or to a large part, elections are won and lost in the suburbs, then I think there's a good argument to be made amongst that. Joe Biden is kind of the reassuring, safe, almost anti-Donald Trump candidate of 2020. If Trump is caustic, abrasive, in-your-face kind of a candidate, I think in part America is looking for somebody who's what the embodiment of all the opposite characteristics. He's low-key, he's calm. Maybe another characteristic I'll do is that, between the U.S. Senate and Vice President, what does Biden have, like 45 years or something like that in Washington? And for good or for bad, I think actually for good, he's got skills. He understands the legislative process. And people may be saying at this point, we actually want somebody who knows what they're talking about and knows what they're doing. Maybe it doesn't push us or doesn't push the political spectrum as far as some of us would like to go, but he sets a new baseline from which you then can launch more progressive politics. And I think that becomes critical. Given his age, maybe Biden is the appropriate transitional candidate, the transitional candidate that again, as I say, sets the baseline and then moves the Democrats to a next generation of leaders, whether it's a Stacey Abrams, whether it is a Kamala Harris, whoever it may be. So he might turn out to be the right candidate at the right time, given his personality.
I think that's a great way to describe it, because as you were kind of saying, people are just looking for at some point someone who knows how to turn the lights on. They're not worrying about the bombasticness of someone like a Donald Trump, or even that hunger we had in 2016 for a real change candidate that, yeah, they're just looking for someone that knows how to turn the lights on, can manage the government, and just go back to having things be so-called normal.
Yeah, if I were going to use one word, now certainly not a good Madison Avenue or marketing line, the line might be that what people are looking for this year, competence.
Mm-hmm.
Just give me somebody who's competent, like you said, who knows how to turn on the lights, who actually knows how to do something. And that may be important. You know, unlike 4 years ago, you know, Hillary Clinton, there's no question she was competent. We can have a really great discussion. In fact, maybe argue that she might have been on one of the most qualified people to ever run for president of the United States. But competence didn't work 4 years ago. I think this year, given 3.5 years of the Trump administration, given how he has bungled the coronavirus, handling of the coronavirus and other things, at the end of the day, people just want somebody who can get something done and perhaps who's not embarrassing to the rest of the world.
We're speaking with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. He is a professor of political science over there and also has his blog, schultzestake.blogspot.com. I want to move on to another topic that you just recently wrote about, and that's the fact that we have federal police being deployed around a number of U.S. cities. Of course, the most prominent were where we had federal agents deployed to Portland, Oregon. Now, in your blog, you wrote about kind of the constitutionality of deploying federal officers to local U.S. cities. Can you talk about that a little bit and whether this technically is constitutional to have a president deploy federal officials to local areas, which normally would be governed by the local police or state police?
Sure. Let's talk about something that many of the listeners already know about. There's this concept called federalism, this idea that there's a division of powers between the national and local government. And if we sort of start from that point of view here, the national government, as designed by the framers, is not supposed to be primarily responsible for law enforcement or policing domestically. This is a function that's left to the states. And in some cases, under state law, to local governments. This is the whole concept of the 10th Amendment, the whole concept of federalism. Unlike some countries which have a national police force, and I refer to in my blog, for example, that in Mexico, sort of the slang term for the national police is the federales. You know, many countries have a national police force. We technically do not have a national police force. We got the FBI who can intervene in some cases. We got the federal government who can protect its own property. But it does not have the day-to-day authority to do policing functions and keep law and order. That is the job of local governments. And under our federalism system, yes, there are situations where local or state governments could request the national government to provide assistance, but that is by request. That is not on their own in terms of sort of sending people in. And this is what's been going on with the Trump administration, just sort of sending in, you know, I almost want to say sending in the Marines to Portland, to Chicago, to Albuquerque, intervening. That raises constitutional questions of itself, on top of which their behavior of what? Arresting, detaining, questioning, maybe roughing up demonstrators raises significant First Amendment, Fifth Amendment issues. And then as I talk about in my blog, the other thing that I'm concerned about here is how these federal agents are acting as what's traditionally known as agent provocateurs, people who go in, try to agitate, to induce people to break the law. And this is what Trump is doing. These people are going in, perhaps intervening in, let us say, a legitimate Black Lives Matter demonstration without local authorities knowing about this, arresting, detaining, again, roughing up. And what does it do? It encourages or incites perhaps a riot. And so Trump is creating the pretext for intervening with a way of what? Diverting attention from the coronavirus, the economy, and appealing to his political base by saying, look at that, there's all this disorder, I need to step in and solve it. And think about what's happening now. 4 years ago, the enemy was what? Immigrants. People breathing at our door who Trump described as what? Rapists and murderers. Now the enemy is internal. It is people of color. It is what? Anarchists, Antifa. So it's still a dividing tactic, but changing slightly who the enemy is.
Yeah, that's certainly a very unsettling thought to think about with that. And even talking about the strategy as to why he's doing this, you were saying that it certainly appeals to his base, but could he also be doing this politically because he sees this as the only way he can try to win back some of these suburban voters by saying, look at these Democratic-controlled cities. They're out of control, and we need to send in our more troops to get law and order restored in these areas. And look at what happens if you put in someone like Joe Biden. He's just going to allow the same sort of chaos that we see in these Democratic-controlled cities. Is this... What do you make of that idea that this could be a way for him to try to win back the suburbs?
I think it is. I think he's appealing to a sense of anxiety about disorder. Mm-hmm. I think he's really appealing to race on this, especially because it seems to be targeting some of the police protests. And all of this is reminiscent of sort of the Nixon 1968 Law and Order campaign, where people seeing images of disorder, seeing images of, let's say, perhaps, the images from Minneapolis and St. Paul, perhaps of some of the rioting that might have occurred by people who are not peaceful protesters. It's appealing to those anxieties and fears in hoping that these perhaps more centrist suburbanite voters will say at the end of the day, gosh, I'm not sure Biden can keep the peace, or yeah, I might agree with these protesters, but this scares me, or even just subconsciously appealing to fear, appealing to some racial biases here and there. So I think that is going on in terms of the psychology to essentially what? Scare people to vote for him again, or at least scare them away from voting for Joe Biden.
Yeah, it's kind of depressing to think about, but you're talking about someone who will go to the lowest common denominator to try to win an election, and that appears to be the case where we're going to go with something as unsettling and dark as having federal police go to different U.S. cities. If it means, hey, I can win back a few suburban voters, well, damn the consequences. That seems to be exactly what he's doing.
Right. The only thing he hasn't done yet, but it's as explicitly, remember, 1988 with George Bush, it was Willie Horton.
Oh,
you know, remember,
mm-hmm.
George Bush was behind by 17 points to Michael Dukakis, and he started hammering Willie Horton and about Michael Dukakis being soft on crime and won. I mean, that was about as an explicit racial appeal as one could get. What I'm worried about is the degree to which Trump either jacks up that language, which might not work with the suburbanites, but works with his base, or does he continue to do these more, I hate to use the word subtle because I don't think it is, but I'll use it anyhow, these more subtle cues that nonetheless still appeal to race as a way of, again, moving voters in his direction.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you could be right on that. We are just about out of time, though, as we've been speaking with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. Make sure you follow his blog over at schultzestake.blogspot.com. David, as always, really appreciate the time today.
My problem, and thank you to the audience for listening.
All right, and I am just about out of time for today. Stay tuned. We got Matt McNeil coming up next, and I will talk to you on Monday.